Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this episode, I'm going to have a conversation with Jim Tomaker, who is working with GTZ in Thailand. Hi, Jim.
How are you? Good to be with you.
What we want to talk about today is value chain development and lessons learned on value chain development, because, Jim, that is what you have been doing for quite some time now. So if you had to introduce to a newbie, somebody who's been dropped into this field without any experience, without any history, and has been tasked with doing value chain development, what are kind of the critical insights or some principles that you would introduce to this person?
Well, the good thing about value chains is that they give you an opportunity to achieve some kind of scale and outreach, and there are lots of potential for using many different instruments that have emerged in private sector development over the last 20 years. You can apply those all to value chains. So a lot of good things that you can do with value chains. However, like most projects, I think one has to get back to the fundamentals and know exactly what you want to achieve. So understanding who your target group is, what their problems are, their constraints and opportunities, is probably the most important lesson coming out of all of this, that you need to do that, and you need to do your analysis and your thinking before you even start trying to do what you think you ought to do. Mm. So that would be the first lesson, I think. Mm.
So when you do your analysis of value chains, what exactly do you analyze? What are the leading questions, the main questions that you would look at in that analysis? Mm-hmm.
The critical questions really are, what do you want to change? Mm-hmm. All development is about trying to change something. Obviously, you want to try and improve whatever you're changing, but it's essential to understand what the change process is and what is going to be required in order to make the change effective and for it to come out in a positive way, because change for the sake of change is never going to get you very far. So understanding the change process is like testing a hypothesis of what needs to happen before something positive is going to develop. Trying that, I mean, being responsible, one has to assume that not everything that you think you can do is going to be positive. So you really have to have a certain amount of discretion, try things out in a relatively small, confined pilot area or with a pilot group. But really what you're trying to do is to test that hypothesis so that you can scale up. And there that gets into this idea of not building value chains around a small group of 15 goat farmers, but really trying to make sure that what you're doing has the scale and outreach to, you know, thousands of herders, so that you're influencing the goat rearing business in a fundamental way. Mm.
So is the main issue that you look at then, what are the main sectors in our economy and what kind of value chains are they a part of, and how can we build that? Or is there also other criteria that you would look at in terms of determining where you start looking? I mean, you have to start looking somewhere. So maybe it's not always your masters who've told you where to go and what to do. So if somebody sends you into the field and says, do something, and it must have value chains in it, where do you start?
Well, I think you start from wherever your, let's say, your main frame of reference is, whether it's poverty, whether it's environment, whether it's youth, whether it's gender. There can be lots of different focuses that you might have. And then you have to look at, let's say you understand your target group, you've identified your target group. What can I do that's going to be relevant to them? What's the most relevant thing? And often we're involved in trying to change the dynamics of how transactions happen with your target group, how value can be added to those transactions so that they will have increased incomes, better jobs, increased standard of living, etc. So if you want to achieve some scale, you really have to look for what's relevant to them. And that's a question of taking off your own glasses, putting their glasses on, and understanding what's the most important thing for them. The second critical thing really is achieving some kind of scale. If you really want to be relevant, you can't pick a value chain that's going to be working with 50 families, 20 families here or there. You really want to try and zero in on those kinds of value chains that in their own way, directly or indirectly, are going to have a big outreach to a lot of people that are in your target group. So when you're doing your selection or your screening process, you look for where those transactions happen between your target group and the outside world. Try and make a short list of the ones that are most relevant to them, and then eventually try and figure out how you can try and restructure the transaction that happens between your target group and the value chain in such a way that there's some value added taking place in the direction of your target group.
When you describe a value chain like that, maybe it would be interesting to look at how is this perspective different from, say, a sector perspective. So looking at a given value chain and working with that value chain, how is that different from some sector development approach that somebody would have done in the 1980s or 1990s?
I think it's probably unhelpful to get stuck in subsector approaches, cluster approaches, value chain approaches, for which there are many. And there are histories, and people who write about it will say, this is subsector approach, and these are the references, these are value chain approaches, etc. Fundamentally, as a practitioner, somebody who's involved in development, essentially you're looking for whatever approach is going to give you the maximum impact on the target group that you're looking for. So in terms of looking back to what people did with subsectors, in terms of what people are doing with value chains today, and we're talking about a 30 years different, I think what's really happened is that our understanding of what goes on in the markets and the change process and our understanding of the target group and how they interact with the real world, all of that's moved along. And consequently, all the approaches have moved along. So the approaches weren't necessarily what was wrong per se. It's our application of these approaches which has become much more sophisticated. And the key learning really is not to hold on to any one approach, but to use and to milk any approach as best you can in order to get the maximum impact and advantage that you want to for your target group.
Well, one of the things that I often like to point out, also in terms of explaining to people how value chain development is different from other approaches, is to ask, well, how do you move a chain that is lying on the ground? And obviously the answer is you cannot push it. So if you try to push a chain, you're creating a heap of metal elements. So the only way of moving a chain is by pulling it. And I hope that drives home the point that when you do value chain development, you start with the market. You start with final demand and work your way against the stream upwards through processing, distribution and processing, and early beneficiation up to primary production. Is that maybe one of the big differences nowadays between what we're doing nowadays and what we would have done 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Yes, I think it's become a lot more legitimate for us to engage with the private sector and to understand how the private sector can be used to solve its own problems. And this is a fundamental difference from, when I first started working in socialist Tanzania a number of years ago, the word entrepreneur was a dirty word. Nobody talked about business, and you didn't engage in markets. And even though people today say neoliberalism is dead and the market concept is debunked, it doesn't mean to say that the market has changed from last week until today. The market's still functioning the same way that it did last week, last year. All of those realities are the same as they were forever. It's understanding the market. It's understanding what the principles are, who the actors are, how you can work with those forces that gives you the power to try and restructure how the market works in a way that's going to be more favorable to your target group. That can be more inclusive. That can be more restructuring of how the market works. There are lots of different strategies that you can employ that will try and add positive value to the target group that's interacting with that market. So, yes, a lot of the change has come from, selecting value chains, trying to push them along to the recognition that it is the market which is going to determine what makes a value chain successful, but not just recognizing that it's a market, but how can you shape that market? How can you make that market understand that what you're doing has some relevance? I'll give you a couple of examples. In the last 10 years, there's been a radical shift in consumer demand around topics like fair trade, organic, sustainable food, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not necessarily endorsing any of those, but I'm just saying that the consumer is becoming much more discerning in terms of what happens down the value chain. And as a result of that, they are starting to dictate a lot more of the kinds of social and developmental obligations or objectives that we wanted to achieve with development 20, 30 years ago. And it was very, very difficult to do. I'll give you an example. 30 years ago, I used to try and sell small business management to enterprises, and I did management courses, from here to kingdom come. And it was always a very, very hard sell to get entrepreneurs to realize that management, you could save and be more productive and all the rest of it. Along comes ISO, which is a management system that you need to have in order to access new markets, and then all of a sudden everybody's queuing up to learn new management skills. That's a contrast of a supply versus demand, a push versus a pull, where you're using the market as your instrument for achieving the kind of change that's absolutely essential for the target group that you're working with to change and develop and evolve into something far more efficient and productive.
Now, talking about the market, what I tend to find is that one of the ironies of the way we are interacting with value chains is that on the one hand, we try to make markets work around them, while on the other hand, the very reason why value chains exist is that markets to some extent don't work very well. So when you look at the academic literature on value chains, especially on global value chains, what they tend to point out is that the phenomenon of global value chains, which are pretty integrated and relatively stable configurations, has a lot to do with the fact that so much ongoing communication is needed between buyers and sellers. So much direct technical exchange is needed. There are all these limits in terms of to what extent you can codify specifications for a given product, to what extent standards typically work. That you have this empirical phenomenon of relatively stable value chains, like IKEA's global supply chain or Nike's global supply chain and so on. So I think it's one of the interesting ironies of this whole approach. How do you look at that?
Value chains are nothing if they're not dynamic. Things are changing rapidly all the time. And what's interesting, and I think is an evolution in value chain, supply chain economics over the last 20 years is that value chains or supply chains are increasingly becoming the key source of innovation. Now, innovation, you know, let's back up and define innovation. Innovation, to a large extent, is new products, new processes, and to some extent, technology. Some of that technology is more radical than the others. But what's happening increasingly in value chains is that innovation is starting to take place, has been taking place, certainly in the last couple of generations, and this is more than it used to be in the past, as a result of collaboration between a client and a supplier. And a client will have a new demand, will need the supplier to meet those specifications, change, adapt, a new process may be required. In the new process, a new product comes out. Maybe even somebody says we need to develop a new technology to make that process more efficient. This is a continuous process of innovation, which is relatively new and has emerged in some of the larger value chains, which underlines the recognition that none of these value chains are guaranteed a life beyond the next quarter, and that if you're not innovative and competitive and you don't figure out a way where you can ensure that the people who are supplying you are strong and healthy, just as you're strong and healthy and just as your client is satisfied, if you can't sort of make sure that what comes before you, who you are yourself, and what happens after you is somehow healthy, you're not going to have a dynamic value chain. It's going to be one that's overtaken by events. It's going to be one that sees themselves slowly being eroded in terms of their competitive position. So getting back to your question, I think your premise in terms of static versus dynamic is absolutely essential to understanding how you can maintain competitiveness. Competitiveness is all about change. It's all about innovation. It's all about growth. It's all about learning. It's all about, in fact, development. And the way you can use value chains is to really try and use the system that exists within the value chains in an optimum way so that you're really creating those flows of information and innovation so that everybody's a beneficiary.
Now, when you describe a value chain as a system where constant innovation is going on and is happening at breakneck speed and constant adaptation is needed because the general parameters change all the time and markets develop in ways that is quite different from what everybody had expected half a year ago. And then on the other side, we come in with technical assistance projects where we have a year of fact-finding, then a year of bureaucratic processing until the project is actually started, and then we engage in half a year of research before we start to understand what is happening on the ground. So how do you align that then?
Well, I think you have to be modest in recognizing that value chains existed before we as development agencies come to the party, and that they'll exist in one way or another far after we've left. So we're a visitor to a value chain. Now, it doesn't mean to say that we can't influence that value chain, but it also means that we have to respect the Hippocratic Oath and do no harm, and not really through any kind of ignorant blunders upsets systems and procedures and ways of doing things in the value chain without clearly understanding what the potential outcome would be. Now, it doesn't mean to say that everybody has to have the same interests within a value chain, but I think most people in a value chain want to see the value chain growing, even if it has to change a little bit. and that people are getting a fair share of their of the benefit of the value chain. So I think you really do need to spend an adequate amount of time making sure that you're not treading on things that have been done before and have failed, making sure that you understand the power relationships that exist, not necessarily accepting them per se, but at least understanding them, so that there's an opportunity for you to, when you do feel as if you have something of additional value to add, that there is a process of due consultation and due diligence in terms of the rollout and implementation of whatever you do, on the understanding that you need to be able to withdraw in a respectful and a way that leaves behind something that's sustainable.
Maybe let's come back for a moment to what we talked about briefly earlier, pushing versus pulling chains. I sometimes get the impression that as value chain development, value chain promotion has moved into the mainstream, we are facing the same situation that we've had with other fashionable approaches in the past, like a couple of years ago, cluster development, where then also some government officials said, okay, so here we have these 10 software producers, and now we are going to turn them into a world-class cluster, right, which Michael Enright used to call the wishful thinking cluster. To what extent is that happening around value chains? And to what extent is what you said earlier? So some government official says, okay, let us take these 15 goat farmers and build a whole value chain that starts with them and then connects to some fantastic market somewhere. To what extent is that happening?
It's relative. I mean, sometimes it's correct, sometimes it's incorrect. I think often as an implementing agency, you're presented with fait accompli. I remember several years ago being in Africa and being presented with a couple of million Deutschmarks at that time with the edict, go and build an informal sector industrial estate. Well, exactly. And, you know, it was not a question of please go and do it. It was a question of just get on with it, Jim. It took a little bit of time to take that potentially disastrous situation, because I don't know if you know the history of industrial estates. Yeah. It's pretty abysmal. So to be presented with this pot of money and asked to sort of go and replicate the mistakes of 20 years of history is a pretty depressing edict. So the question is, how can you use that money and structure it in a way that's going to make some sense? So with a lot of participation, a lot of thinking, a lot of involvement of many, many stakeholders, we ended up building five of these things with counterpart money from the informal sector and the nonprofit organizations in situations that resulted in, you know, several thousand employment places for employment being created in a sustainable way. It took 2.5 years, and I can't say that it was an easy thing. But I wanted to point that out as an illustration that very often you are given a hand that you're not particularly keen on dealing or on handling. And I think it's up to us as development agencies to try and be as, I hesitate to use the word creative, but I think imaginative, at least in terms of what you can do with that money so that it's going to certainly, in the first case, do the least harm. Mm-hmm. But in an optimistic case, use it in a way that's going to have some positive impact. So if some high up official says there will be a value chain in this area and it's going to be I hate to pick on the goats again, but
let's take chicken.
Okay, let's take chickens. Mm-hmm. It's going to be chickens. It's up to you to try and find out how you can do that in the most sensible and creative way that's going to have an impact on the target group in a lasting and meaningful manner. I leave it at that. I'm sure there are lots of examples of projects where people have been given similar briefs and have tried to do that kind of thing. And I think that's not going to go away tomorrow. Mm. Development is an extension of public expenditure policy, and public expenditure will be there from now until kingdom come, and legitimately so, because the overall philosophy of that is that you are trying to create a certain amount of distribution of that wealth in a way that's going to result in a more productive and sustainable society. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of really how you use it, how you interpret it, and how much leverage you're given. I think what's really bad for a lot of situations is where people take money and just follow the dots, follow the arrows, and just sort of waste the money, and at the end of the 5 years of however the money is gone, they sort of wipe their brow and say, I'm glad that's over, and now I can move on to something more productive. Try to do whatever you can. I mean, push against the system where you think it's wrong.
Maybe to wind up this conversation, let me come to the role of buyers. Now, one of the things that we can take out of the literature on value chains, but also something that we experience practically a lot, is that power is very unevenly distributed along a value chain, and especially in those cases where you're interacting with a value chain that results directly in a consumer product that is then sold at large retailers, you tend to find that those retailers are the most powerful players in the value chain. So obviously, whenever you do value chain development in a subsector where these conditions apply, you would try to engage with such buyers, or wouldn't you?
I mean, you're talking about an exceptional case for a value chain project, because this is obviously a value chain that's doing reasonably well, has a good market, and where the power is with the retailers and all the rest of it. So it may not be, the cherry that you pick. However, if you are, let's say you are dealt a hand something like that, where the power is very much with the retailers, I think what you try and use the systems that exist that are important to the retailers, where they're going to listen. And what do they listen to? They listen to their consumers. So if you can do end runs around the retailers and address the consumers, either with things like fair trade issues or other issues that are valid and are going to impact on how the retailer perceives the shifting dynamics of the market, because the retailer will listen to the market more than anything, then you may be in a situation where the retailer is a lot more willing to play with you and a lot more willing to do things with you down the value chain, which are going to make the retailer look good to the consumer. So I think you have to sort of use the market to try and get the retailer on your side doing the things that you want to try and do.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Jim, for your inputs.
Okay. You're welcome, York.